How does government typically work? Historically, things run along this line. You land on an idea that seems like a good one, execute it, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. A perfect example of the latter might be the Flint water crisis. Somehow, the idea of saving $100 a day by not adding corrosion control chemicals seemed like a good idea to someone at the time. And there are many cases of money spent by government on efforts that may work or may not. That's why we're seeing governments turning to something called a nudge unit, using scientific insights about the way we behave to help politicians determine policy. Just how do nudge units work, and are they able to tackle some of our biggest problems? Joe Arvai is with us. He is the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources. He also directs the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. Joe, this idea of a nudge unit, it began in the UK?
Yeah, that's right. Preceding that, there has been a lot of interest in looking at behavioral insights and how we actually make our decisions and behave as human beings. And to try and tap into that, early on, the emphasis was on correcting our behaviors, identifying things that we did well, reinforcing those, identifying things where we struggled, and trying to correct those. And then what came about around 2008, popularized in 2008 with the publication of a book called Nudge, was the idea of seizing upon our predictable biases and our predictable tendencies in decision-making to help us make choices in our own self-interest without us really even knowing that it was happening. So, of course, government jumped on this as an opportunity to see if they could make us wealthier, healthier, and so on.
So how? Give me an idea how it's been used in England, and then you were saying that this idea has really grown around the globe.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. So one thing that we know from behavioral science is that people like to kind of fall back on the status quo or on defaults when they're making decisions. So if we're presented with a default or a status quo alternative, that instinctively feels right. There's sort of an implicit endorsement in looking at a status quo and accepting it.
So as my late mother-in-law from Ireland used to say, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Precisely. Absolutely precisely. So if we look at something like organ donation rates, if you look at organ donation rates in North America, somewhere between 20 and 30% is considered to be quite good. And the reason for this is that if you want to become an organ donor, you go to the DMV when you get your license, mm-hmm. and it says, if you want to be an organ donor, check this box. And you actually have to read it, you have to understand it, you have to think about it, then you have to take action and check that box. In Europe, what they've done is they've basically said, hey, when you come in to get your driver's license, you are an organ donor. And if you don't want to be an organ donor, check this box. And that simple shift to moving organ donation to the default leads to organ donation rates in Europe at around 90 to 100%.
Because it's just there, so you don't have to stop and think about the fact you may die.
Absolutely. So governments have now run with this, and they've said if we want to get people to invest in savings and retirement plans, when you're hired by certain employers, the default now is you're automatically enrolled in this plan. It's sort of a one-size-fits-all plan, so at least you're getting something.
But this is influencing the public without us knowing it, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And there's a lot of hue and cry about whether or not this is ethical or appropriate. I think the thing to keep in mind when you think about a nudge unit is the environment in which we make decisions is providing us with context no matter what. So the idea is, from a policy perspective, if we can then take some active control of that, modify the environment in such a way that people will make choices in their best interests. And here's the key, without curtailing their ability to choose something else if they want, without sort of increasing the transaction cost of making that different choice.
Because this is not a dictatorship.
Exactly. Then it works. So the argument is, with something like that organ donation form, how hard is it to check that box and not be an organ donor? The argument is not very hard. So it's not kind of coercive in that regard.
You say there's sometimes a nudge really isn't enough, such as...
Yeah, and this is the important thing. So when we look at the big complicated decisions that we make, ones that involve multiple stakeholders, long time horizons, lots of uncertainty.
Like global warming, global climate change.
Yeah, yep. Global warming is a key example. I think what happened in Flint, as you alluded to in your intro, is a fantastic example. If we look at what we're doing with the refugee crisis in Syria, these are decisions where you can't sort of put something at proverbial kind of eye level or default level. These kinds of decisions involve a heavy lift. They involve thinking about consequences in ways that we're not accustomed to thinking about it. And in fact, just to use the example from earlier, our propensity to love the status quo actually hurts us in these situations, because we'll just look to Syria or Flint or whatever and say, hey, this is what we've always done in the past. It hasn't really bitten us hard before. So let's do it again. What's the harm? And then every so often something like Flink comes along and shows us.
And you talk about something called active decision support for these kind of heavy lift issues. What is that and how does that work?
Well, basically active decision support means that we have to modify the processes we use when we make choices. So if we go back to nudges, I call those passive decision support because you don't even really know they're happening. You don't have to think. You just go with your gut and make decisions. And if the engineer who made the environment in which you're choosing did a good job, then you're going to be making good choices. Active decision support basically involves taking a complicated problem, breaking it up into manageable parts, and working with a decision maker step by step by step through that process so that they can make a better and more defensible decision. The kicker is when it comes to nudge units, governments have jumped on this, as I said, and they're saying, hey, this is an area where we need specialized expertise. Let's invest in that. The assumption with active decision support is if you're smart and intelligent and experienced, you should be able to do this on your own. The science tells us not even close. So why not invest in these kinds of insights in government as well?
What might this look like then? Let's talk about our globe and about our climate and how might this active decision support work for helping us be able to influence things?
Active decision support involves a few key components that science has shown us can be very effective. The first is it helps us to think about the problems and opportunities that we're confronting. A lot of times we make assumptions about the problem that's in front of us or the opportunity that we're facing and think that we know what's going on there. We think we know what the boundaries are around it. We think we know who the stakeholders and the important players in that decision ought to be, and we proceed. We don't really stop and ask ourselves, hey, is this really the right choice we ought to be making? Secondly, we find that people don't do a very good job of articulating what it is they want to get out of those decisions. We don't think about our values and we don't think about our objectives as precursors to making decisions. From that, we don't then think about how we actually measure success. So we go into decisions both with an uneven and sort of ill-defined playing field and without a very good idea of what it is that we're hoping to get. And then to your point about Flint, we also see that people don't like to think about alternatives. They jump on one thing as the way to go. They might tag a few ornaments on that and think that it's a little bit different, but they don't give themselves the opportunity to evaluate a wide spread of alternatives in a creative and thoughtful way.
Yeah, those bureaucratic blinders were on in a big way.
Absolutely. And it's not uncommon and it's not unique to Flint for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's not a sign of maliciousness. I mean, I don't know the legal ins and outs of the Flint case or other cases, but for most of the decisions that I've worked on, there is no kind of nefarious individual. Yeah,
yeah.
There's no one in there trying to mess with you. It's really just how we instinctively do it and we kind of proceed. I'll tell you one other thing. One thing that people really hate to do is make trade-offs. So if you have to give something up to get something else that you value, but for different reasons, that creates a conflict. And the easiest way to resolve that conflict is to ignore it. So once again, we start making decisions based on single variables. What's the cheapest? What's the fastest? What's the perceived safest? Without really thinking about how much safety do we give up for this saving? How much sort of long-term flexibility do we lose in return for this particular saving? So it's hard.
So in an ideal world, Joe, would state governments have a active decision support team there to help advise policy decisions? How might this work in the real world?
You know what? I think you nailed it. I think that's exactly what needs to happen. And it's happening in other domains. So if you look at government offices and their marketing and communications teams, they've got specialists that know how the public responds to messages, and they work with the team, with the politicians, with the bureaucrats to craft messages in a constructive and defensible way. With the passive decision support stuff, we see these people skilled in behavioral science who are there helping to inform policy. When it comes to the decisions that require the heavy lift, we don't see that. We have this sort of assumption that, again, smart people with good intentions will do the right thing, and there isn't that capability there. So what I'm arguing for and what I've been arguing for quite some time is to begin to build that capacity in government, in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector, starting with small offices of people who are there to help structure these complicated decisions for people.
I love the term you use, choice architects.
Yeah, and that's kind of the buzzword that's out there. And again, it's all about engineering that environment in which people choose on the passive side. But listen, a choice architect can also help you structure the process you use to make those complicated decisions.
But there's a dangerous line that could be crossed.
Absolutely. And it's being crossed. So I think, if you look at it from the standpoint of what governments are doing, they're trying to serve your best interests, or at least that's what the nudge units say their mission is. If you cross the line into the private sector, it becomes marketing and consumer choice. And listen, let's not be fooled by the fact that the groceries that are at eye level in the grocery store aren't there by accident. People are paying to put those products there because they know eye level is an implied default at the status quo. That's why the magazines are at the checkout counter and not in the back of the store. So you can really take advantage of this stuff to get people to do what you want. I think the key with choice architecture, whether it's on the passive side or the active side, is to always maintain freedom of choice. It's not about prescribing an alternative. It's about helping you make choices that are in your own best interest. And I know people are going to listen to this and think, wow, that's crazy. This is dangerous. He's crazy. This can be done right. And that's what I'm hoping for.
The piece that Joe wrote is in theconversation.com. Society's biggest problems need more than a nudge. Joe Arvai is the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the School of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan, where he also directs the Urb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. Great ideas, Joe. Thank you so much for sharing them with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.